This is Betty Smith, May 16, 1992. Finding the Voice of the Self, Tape 3 of 3.
It's like if there's something that's running away, you let that go. You can't force, because to force is not an idea that's not... To force a conception against its will is rape. Not that Zeus hasn't been guilty of that before, but in this instance, he chose to not pursue and to go to the piece that was receptive.
That was receptive in him.
And not chase the one that was...
And laughter is a kind of ecstasy that comes out of the earth, is it not, at that point? That the Homeric hymn speaks of the laughter that comes up out of Asteria, joyous laughter, with this final coming together, really, with Zeus as well as her sister. I mean, in a way, with Zeus, the Zeus birth, the Zeus Leto Asteria birth.
Is there any other information on why Poseidon chose to involve himself in that relationship and to anchor her down? Is there any past
exactly.
history between them or future where they interact?
He was a builder. There are some historical references of him, or mythological ones, that he was a builder of walls, and I think he built the walls of Troy, if I'm not mistaken, or helped with the foundational parts. And even though he's a god of the sea, he was a god of certain land, land portions, and strong structure.
Just in the sense that the foundation is always beneath the water line, I mean, is that...
Maybe so. The coming together of water and land. Mm-hmm. Yes. Of course, he very much wanted the Acropolis as his piece, too, and that didn't work out. The gods decided for Athena instead of Poseidon. He was the god of underground springs too, which I find very important in as an image in the work with Psyche, because the underground springs are something that here and there you do discover in your work, in your dreams. You discover something that really brings up a real refreshment to the psyche, or a real possibility, a new vitality, a new source for oneself, a new avenue or a new way. And actually, I know there was an underground spring at Delphi for which there was some worship of Poseidon in connection with it. I think it was Cassotis, but I'm not sure. Sacred spring. Now we move to, we've been talking about the parts of the soul and the duality of the soul, And you cannot reduce one to the other, we should say once again in parting, hoping you can bring them into some kind of harmony or collaboration when the time is ripe. When the work is done and the time is ripe, that Asteria will join Leto and the divine child of the psyche can emerge. But until it does, but there is never any reducing of the one to the other. And I think this is important to remember in all relationship too, relationships of people, intimate relationships, close relationships, that there is a nocturnal side to everybody's soul that can't be married or can't be, will not enter permanent covenants. And it's very, you might as well respect that side, that nocturnal side. And it's part of the real texture and the eternal, the only word I can think of is virginity, whether in male or female, the eternal virginity of the soul. A real Artemis archetype that's carried in the soul. I think it's a real Artemis archetype. Artemis, who is deep, deeply embedded in nature, near the streams, in touch with the animals, and in touch with birth. Artemis is very associated to birth, even though she remains virginal. Very much a nurse of children and a midwife with babies and with animals at their birth. Even though she can be a huntress also. But she carries that, and there's this given nature in the individual person. There's a certain givenness that you can't push against, I think, that cannot be altered. And if you care for somebody deeply, you have to care for that givenness, that sort of impenetrable nature or thicket. It's deep woods in us, surrounded by the beast. Not necessarily purely wild, but natural. And I think that's not unrelated to Asteria somehow here. And the freshness that comes with the life of soul, either in your inner work or in a creative work, when it gets into a creative work, the freshness that comes, I think, has to do with this nocturnal quality, or this Artemis or nocturnal quality. She's a mediator of the wilds, of wildness. She is not wild, Artemis, but she is a mediator of the wildness. So she kind of walks the boundary between conscious and unconscious, between what is known and lived versus what is unexplored and even beyond ever touch, ever quite reaching. Something important to us, I think. Indeed, I once discussed with a rabbi at a Jewish wedding the breaking with the heel of the what you call it, the glass, and I had just been working in an Artemis seminar on the play of Euripides, Alcestis, and what is his name? The king that she was married to. What? Euripides' play, but I was trying to think of Alcestis' husband's name. Admetus was his name. And Admetus forgot the marriage offering to Artemis. And there were snakes in his wedding bed as a result. And then the next thing that happened was his death was required. Artemis required his death because he forgot the marriage. And I was talking this over with the rabbi. It somehow came up in the notion. He said that the stamping of the glass, he said originally, was an awareness of the end of the virginity, that the hymen of the woman is broken. And it's a kind of ritual acknowledgement of the breaking of the virginity in the marriage. And so that gave me food for thought, that Admetus forgot to honor the great virgin Artemis in the marriage, which was required in Thessaly in that time. And his death was required. Well, I'll let you read the play. He didn't die, and it's a very, very interesting happening out of that that involves his wife. But somehow there has to be an acknowledgement, and it seems to me in marriage, that something that says, I will not destroy. Outwardly, I take the virginity of the other person. I think the woman takes it from the man as well as the man takes it from the woman. I take something from the other person, but I must not try to steal or possess the essential virginity in the other, person. It seems to me that came to me as a possibility of that interpretation. All this from Artemis, but trying to understand what Artemis had such a tremendous demand upon that marriage. You got any ideas? I don't know whether that's...
I just have a pretty bizarre piece of synchronicity. I was at a Jewish wedding with my mother as a child, and she found a piece of broken glass in her sour cream.
Oh. Oh, wow.
One unto
so himself, right.
Yeah.
I remember she does.
The
same unto oneselfness that cannot be taken or from another or controlled. Or either taken from another or controlled or manipulated or and really not appropriately given. The other can be touched by it in the oneself, but it can't be given away. Seems to me. What? Should not. That's a better word. Should not be given away.
What I'm aware of as a therapist is that much of the process is to restore that psychological virginity to people, for them to find a way to renew it. You know, you can't ever give it back to somebody, but they can, through the dreams, often find a way to recover what was stolen from them, whether it was literal or metaphorical. You know. I mean, it's always literal, I think, on some level, that somehow this being has really been violated in the psyche, sometimes also in the body, but so much in the psyche that it's really been destroyed before they ever get to the wedding in the outer world, but they don't know that there was something that they ought to protect.
Yes. Oh, I think we're very unaware. Yes. And I'm glad to hear you say that's what therapy is about.
It's giving it back. It's getting it back.
It's helping one to recover that. Yes.
If this was the content of the myth, retaining one's virginity, so to speak, one's inner self, what was the actual outer life of the community? Day-to-day life of the Greeks, well, what was the custom as far as man's view of his wife or of a woman at that time?
Well, this doesn't always reflect in social forms immediately, just as all the freedoms that belonged to the goddesses did not belong to Greek women. I mean, there was the social forms did not follow closely the... You don't quite have the same.
Because following religions, Hinduism, Christianity, and spoke of the uniting of two as one, and the women and the children being property. Was that?
Well, the wives were property. The wives were property, as they were in most societies.
And yet there was a psychological understanding somewhere in order for these myths.
I don't say it's a psychological understanding. It was still in the collective psyche. Yeah, in the collective psyche somewhere it exists. And that's why it could finally, you know, could come forth. But it doesn't mean that it was a conscious understanding of it quite. But it did affect the values of the people. There's a lot of individuality, I find, in just reading Greek literature. A lot of individuality paid women, much more than I experienced in the 20th century growing up in my hometown about women. Mrs. So-and-so's children with her husband's name, but always in, or the children, or the name might just be given of the father. In Greek stories, always the mother's name is given along with the father's name. And it's never just the, as for example it was in the Jewish custom to name the father and the children of, like the children of Abraham, the children of Jacob. You wouldn't have that in Greek mythology. Or you would never even have just the children of Zeus. Even Zeus's wife would be named if she's human, you see. So there was a kind of individuality in the role of women.
is homosexuality dealt with in this?
Very accepted, very much accepted, was usually male's homosexuality. And it was a training ground for oftentimes for a young man in a certain period in his life before he's ready for marriage. Or a boy is taken by an older man and is loved by that man. We read of some of these stories from the ancient time, and learns values, learns philosophy, is trained by the masculine, but trained in a loving relationship, and then reaches a point where he's married to a woman, and that relationship takes over. I don't know whether it never does, but it doesn't seem to.
Stories in mythology, though. Are you talking mythology, or are you talking?
No, I'm really talking actual Greek literature about, and also people who have. Not always. Sometimes there's some historical fiction that is played on those, like in the novels of. Well, I'll talk about that later. I don't want to take too much away from our focus in the seminar, but it certainly was an accepted mode. And by the Greeks. But they also honored the marriage of man and woman. It was not very often that a man would take a relationship for life with another man, as far as I know. Zeus and Ganymede might be one. Where Zeus takes Ganymede as his cupbearer and his lover. Can you think of any others? Is that? Now, of course, the poetry of Sappho has many lesbian kind of poems. We call them lesbian. They come from the island of Lesbos. More poetry, and she was very much a worshiper of Aphrodite. They're all going to have something to do with the archetype, aren't they, somewhere? You mean what occurs in literature would be in the, you mean in the historical literature?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. As literature or poetry, as opposed to always the stories of the gods. It's
yes.
Larger, super
yes.
Level of
yeah, right. So, I think you have in Homer's stories, in the Iliad, and partly in the Odyssey, especially the Odyssey. But there are lovers among the warriors, which was common. Mm-hmm. But yes, I think the archetype plays an important part if it comes up through poetry or literature or myth. Sure. Now, our time is slip by, but I want to give you two images to be chewing on at lunch through this period. Well, just in passing, in leaving the story of Apollo and Leto and Artemis, I want to say, I don't mean Artemis, I mean Themis. We want to say something further about Themis. That Themis takes the infant child. Themis takes the infant Apollo, the child Apollo, I should say. He is not taken to his mother's breast. It is not the usual thing for a goddess to spend a period of nurture time with her baby. But the child is taken by the nurse, Themis, the older goddess, of an older generation, and she gives him his first food, which is nectar and ambrosia, the food of the gods. And it is said that she also was the nurse of infant Zeus, Themis was. So a very nurturing goddess, and don't forget, she's the goddess who had the dream oracle. And I think it's quite appropriate, don't you, that she nurtures the new life. She's really with what is emerging out of the psyche, the new life. And very soon he goes to Delphi, and he's still very, very soon, and has his claims there, but that doesn't concern us right now. There, I think we won't go into the afternoon, into the next images perhaps, but to think that there is, we've been emphasizing the nocturnal aspect of the soul and honoring it, but now there is the light of Apollo, which is something quite different. The light of the spirit, the light of logos, the word in this very deep sense of the luminous form that takes the substance of life and shapes it and gives it some sort of enduring luminous form. That's what logos is about. It's never words in the plural. It's not just verbalization, but it is the word as it's spoken of in the Gospel of John also. In the beginning was logos, and that God was the logos. Here is Apollo, and he brings the oracle from the dream place to a place of bridging with language to the human world, to the human predicament. He's a god very much concerned with the human condition, even though he stays distant. But he's very concerned with the human predicament and helping individuals out of that predicament with just a few well-chosen, in this case, words. But it is, he gives a shape, a luminous shape to things, so that architecture and all the arts are related to Apollo. They shape, they give the form, the luminous form that carries the light of Apollo in it. He is the great healer of the gods. So I think all this is connected to the voice of the self in the psyche, as we're seeing it, particularly through Apollo here. He's the, what was the last thing I said?
Healer.
So he, as healer, he's called Peon. 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 I always have to write it out. Peon. Peon. The word P-A-E-A-N, isn't it? And sometimes, it's spelled P-A-E-I-O-N. I think there's an I-O-N in the original. Peon. Meaning the great healer god. And then the songs of praise to Peon, Apollo, were called Peons, in an A-N. Songs of praise were called Peons because they were sung to Peon, Apollo, the great healer. And yet you don't see very much direct kind of healing coming from Apollo. He did heal land from plagues. Took away plagues from the land.
Also, to see that the human then of the gap that is bridged by Logos,
then the healing is a closer up. Yes.
Pulling together the consciousness and the unconsciousness.
Mm-hmm. Seems to be more of a connecting in the healing. Yes, more direct or close connecting.
I was curious the relation then between Apollo and Asclepius.
Yes, I was just going to come to that. Asclepius is his son, his great son, and so he carries forth being a human being before he became a god. Asclepius carries forward into the human world the compassion and the concern for healing. But that comes from Apollo. There was an altar to Apollo each of the healing shrines had an altar to Apollo too. But Asclepius carries that forward. So I wanted just to mention that what the Logos is. And I think when we come to important important quality of consciousness in our inner work, it does begin to take on a luminous shape. And we can say certain important words. I don't mean we can explain everything. But words that have a penetrating meaning for us become very important at certain points in our work. Certain few words that have a penetrating meaning. Sometimes a word comes in a dream, a phrase in a dream, that takes on a real luminosity. And I think that is that Apollonian light that comes through there. It's unfortunate that in English literature and 19th, 20th century, Apollo came to be identified with reason, because I think this sells him off short. Yes, he has
perfectly
the mind. What?
Perfectly reasonable.
It's very reasonable. Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, you know, we say the word, and he was connected to law, and he was such an authority, came to be such an authority on what states should do as a great counselor. But I think any god who's the god of music and the god of an oracle whose main bridge is an ecstatic priestess is touching another root in a profound way. And his whole connection is to music and dance is a very, very profound connection.
Will you be speaking of Dionysus in connection with Apollo today?
Not today. He is on the same mountain, and they did have a very friendly relationship in that Dionysus did keep the sanctuary in the wintertime at Delphi. And there was a resurrection rite every so often, too, as we said last night, to Dionysus that was performed at Delphi. And maybe the resurrection rite to Dionysus' mother's Semele might have been performed at Delphi. So they're not worlds apart, as it were, although they are very different in personality and general attributes.
I find it interesting that Athena, who I think of as the goddess of the sun, also was connected with the arts. And I guess I
yes.
see Apollo and Athena's
yes.
connection.
Yes, and she's very connected to Apollo. Mm-hmm. Right. Very connected. Well, we need to take our lunch time, and we'll come back at 10 till 2. With no, this is fairly well known to most of you, and I'm going to be brief in the working with a dream. Other than the basic approach to the inner work that we began with, the cultivating the inner amplitude and our dual attitude of the conscious side, the reality, ego presence, which is very important, by the way, in active imagination too, that the ego be present and the receptive aspect towards the unconscious. But in addition to those, in working with the dream, just a few specifics. If any of you are new to this, it's first important to establish the context of a dream, the setting of the dream. You're in a classroom, you're at home, you're in a house that's said to be yours, but you've never seen it before. Whatever is the context or setting of the dream takes on significance. The time of day also with the context, or anything having to do with season in the context. And especially if the season in the dream is a different season from the one you happen to be in consciously. If it's winter in the dream and it's summertime for you, in general, in the outer world, then it's, of course, much more significant. And what the atmosphere or setting feels like to you, your response to it, is quite important. Oftentimes, that setting or that context of the dream will seem unrelated to the rest of the dream. Or as the dream moves on, and as the action of the dream moves on, you're doing things that perhaps don't even seem appropriate to that context. For example, you may have started out in a classroom, and maybe as the dream progresses, you're in a pasture or some other such place. But it is significant where a dream begins.
Is this?
Oh. Okay. Taking this off.
Well, turning it, putting it on your back so that the microphone won't come into it. I mean, just putting the necklace. No, I mean, just turning the necklace.
Oh, I wasn't sure. Well, now that's going to point the wrong way. Huh? Ooh. Yeah. Will that still work? That doesn't work. Does that work? Does it work? Does it work? Oh, every direction. Okay. All right. I think it's okay. No, that's all right. I want it to be. I don't want to lose half of it. Thank you. As an example of context, I remember one of the early dreams of my own analytical work. In fact, it was a series of dreams that began with the same setting. I was in a history classroom, or I was on my way trying to get to the history classroom. Very significant. And there were blockages in the first dream. And as time went on, I got there and I was going to flunk the test because I'd missed most of the semester, but I had wandered in on test day and this sort of thing. Dream after dream after dream. And I finally had to be almost literal with it, that in some way my psyche had the viewpoint that I was failing history. That there was something of historical responsibility or what, but the interpretation isn't so important just now as the, but something that I was failing, and it took the form of history. I had never majored in history. It was not my favorite subject as an academic subject, but it was very telling, and sometimes the dream went on to other things, but it started in history classroom with anxiety. So both the mood of a dream is important to take note of, as well as the setting. And then, of course, look at the main happening of the dream, or the series of happenings. It's observe any conflict that takes place. Try to be able to say to yourself, this is against this, not terribly interpretive, but this kind of figure opposes this kind of a figure. One really tries to get the structure of the dream first, I think. And then write down your feelings or your associations to each figure. This is not free associating, which Jung, by the way, took a dim view of free association, but actual association or acquaintance with each figure, or the way that you can find that you feel about each figure. So it may be spontaneous response, but it's not quite the same as free association. So if there is a difference. But you write down your feeling responses and your associations too. It's important to write it down and not merely to think it, because if you allow yourself to write down all of your associations, you may include ones that, if you left it up to what you're going to remember, you do already a cancellation process. Well, that's not as important as this, and this is not important as that. But when you go back and look at a dream and look at the associations you wrote down, something new may stand out from the list that didn't strike you as very important at the time. Now, if you are dreaming of someone close to yourself, or, yes, especially somebody close in relationship, it's very important to look at the dream event in terms of the outer relationship, I mean the reality relationship to that person. That is, to begin with that. Or at least come to that. That is, before you search out what that person could mean in your psyche, how it could contribute in the dynamics of your psyche, you really need to know how it is in that relationship. Since it is being played out and a great deal is carried for you in the outer relationship. Otherwise, you can go unconscious. This is particularly true when you dream of a spouse or partner, brother, sister. And so in the end, in a very thorough work, inner work, you find yourself having to work on the outside and the inside in the way that you think about and relate to that figure. Don't you think that's true? You have to work both ways. Yes.
I'm not so clear about that. Does that mean, like, say with a spouse that you know you're getting along or you feel you're not getting along, is that an out exterior circumstance?
Yes, just talking about, well, I'm calling anything that belongs to the conscious reality relationship as outside. I don't mean it doesn't have any inner components, but... So if it's a spouse, anything that has to do with the marriage in relationship to the spouse would be something that you would associate there. Mm-hmm. Yes. And then it helps you to move from that level to the dream as happening within the psyche. And that is where you begin to see, you begin to acknowledge the role of these figures in you. It's not quite as if you look at every figure in the dream and say, that's me, that's me, that's me. That might be the first, early on we do that to a certain extent. They're not specifically ever ego. But that's an aspect of myself. That's an aspect of my psyche. There's a difference in that. And we say that when you dream of figures of the same sex, and there's quite a, especially if there's conflict between yourself in the dream, the ego of the dream ego, and somebody of the same sex, very often that's, there you have a shadow conflict. The shadow, personal shadow, is of the same sex as the dreamer, they say. And of course, you should write down the resolution of the dream, how the dream ends, the outcome of it. And I usually like to entitle a dream. Give it a... I started doing that with my own dreams to... really for filing purposes. You think that's funny?
Yeah, no, I think
that's delightful. Do you? But, I mean, very simple titles, like... So I really see the characters. Nothing clever. Well, all right. Suppose in the dream, I would, in a history class dream, I'd say, history class dream 5, or history, you know, when it was a series, or history dream 5. I often would name it by the action of the dream. Strange man fills pot with wine, or... you know, just very, nothing clever, nothing literary, but so I can identify the central action. And then if I want to flip through some dreams looking for a similar motif, thank you. If I wanted to look through a similar motif, I can find that with the, thank you very much. And if you have dreams, maybe a certain animal is appearing in your dreams. So I name the animal, or I may have subtitle, or say, if it is an elephant in this dream, and I've had an elephant in another dream, I may want to trace through where the elephants came, or lion, or something. I should do that.
Somehow, yeah.
I was thinking about your comment a moment ago about writing down some of these things as a way of preventing a certain editing process. But one of the things that I find when I write things down that I have a different editing process about thinking of certain things that I might find difficult to face and might find difficult to have other people be able to see should they ever read this.
Oh,
and
I see.
Catch myself doing a certain kind of editing maybe even more strongly than if I were just to sit with it myself, and might be more willing to face it in the thought process than putting it down.
Well, now that's an interesting problem, yes. Sometimes people can use initials for names they don't want to expose in their dreams. Certain initials, or have a little code name or something.
Fractions also.
What?
Fractions
too. A code name for action if you don't want anybody reading about.
Things that you would maybe, I've got an idea. Well, it's easy to identify it, assuming that I know what that means.
All right. Well, those do present problems. How to lock your dreams up. But you know, I've also discovered with a few people who have worried about, I remember working with a woman for some time who worried about her husband reading her dreams. She was the most devoted and faithful and attentive wife I've ever known. I mean, barring none. But she worried about her husband reading her dream. And finally I decided it said something about her. In fact, she even said that you've had, maybe as a guide, or good, helpful figures of dreams, may be called up again. If you've never done that before, you may find that very, very helpful, is to remember a dream you had with a very helpful figure that made you feel, for whom you felt very grateful, and a trustworthy figure. And you may be able to call that figure up in a kind of dialogue if active imagination scares you, and try a different word. But it means simply to have a conversation with, between the ego and the figure. And one of the things I've learned about active imagination is not to demand at once, now, why did you do such and such in the dream? What does that mean that you did such and such? If immediately you demand this dream figure to be your analyst, as it were, it kind of breaks down, the process breaks down, or it's overwhelming to the dream. And if you can begin with a feeling response to the figure you're having the conversation with, the dream figure, whether it's a negative response or a positive one, begin with it. You may find you get a little conversation going. You never see ahead what's going to develop in an active imagination. You don't have an outline of an active imagination, you know, and you let it come as it will. Suddenly you see this dream figure that acts a little bit stupid, and so you tell him acts a little bit stupid in the dream, and or passive or unhelpful, and you go on and try to get something more than monosyllables out of him, and then at some point he's going to remind you of somebody, and maybe you'll say that, and it's marvelous how one can go from, if you will, risk the first three exchanges with an inner figure. Yeah, three or four exchanges. He tells a line, you tell a line. He tells a line, you tell a line. If you will risk that far, something usually or very often begins to be embodied. There's some feeling of substance coming in, a little growing sense of reality. You do have to work with the feeling that it's very common to feel I'm writing fiction. I'm engaging in fiction. I'm making it all up. So, in fact, you might just include that as another voice in the active imagination, as the one who's let him have his little, or her have her little refrain, you're making it all up, and let her have her peace. But it's important to realize that's only one point of view from the ego, from something in the ego side. I'm not sure I know what fiction is at this point. When the imaginal life begins to flow, if there's anything that we engage the imaginal life for, the life of imagery, it is to bring us human truth, human and individual truth, real human truth. And even if it comes in unlikely images or dream-like events, we learn in time to penetrate the truth through that. So one does have to trust it somewhat. The time when I find it most useful to dream a dream forward, or to fantasize it forward as a conscious activity, is when a dream has been kind of really abruptly stopped or interrupted, when some important action was underway. In other words, a feeling of disappointment, a feeling of just a feeling of interruption. And so I try to take the dream up more or less where it left off, get into that scene, and see what can happen. It can be useful. It's not as useful in my experience as active imagination, however. But different people, different things work well with. And the reason for tending the dream, uh, is also because you have archetypes behind some things in the dreams. You could ask whether you have archetypes behind everything, but you have obviously archetypes in some dreams, very obviously archetypes. And the only way to begin to perceive what the archetype is there for, what is its presence there, what's the import of its presence, is to tend it a bit, to give it a little expansion. So if quite often people bring me dreams that have mythological, sometimes I see somebody on a short basis with mythological components in their dreams, and if they're convinced then that they have Aphrodite aspect in the dream, qualities of Aphrodite, then they begin to look at Aphrodite myths. This is a way you can amplify the archetype. Look at Aphrodite myths, rites to Aphrodite, get a feel for what the Aphrodite is like, or Hephaestus, or whoever, whatever is coming up as a motif in a dream. Now, you may not, myth happens to be my area, so I recognize some of those more quickly than I would some other aspects of archetypes. But Greek mythology I recognize somewhat. I'll give you a dream as a demonstration. I also want to emphasize, so one more point besides tending the dream, is something I said in the very beginning, is to find what works as a gateway for you. It is crucial to enter a protected inner territory wherein who you are simply is honored and allowed. So you have to move in the inner world where you are allowed to move and where something constitutes a gateway for you. As we said last night, Hermes is god of the gate, god of the journey, and god of souls, really just generally god of souls. So sometimes the mythology of Hermes, if you're just trying to think about gateway or doorway or get the sense of the importance of gateway or threshold, because our type is such in the United States, our psychological type, plus our cultural development towards candor and directness, our extroversion and our extreme candor causes us not to respect the role of gateway or threshold. You know? With threshold or gateway? What? Hecate is very much a goddess of the crossroads. Yes. Uh-huh. Where three ways meet. And so she's a god of the road, in that important goddess of the road in that respect. Yeah, I said Artemis, for whom I said whom Asteria reflects. Yes. Uh-huh, yes. Hestia is there at the hearth, and all the gods and goddesses bridge something, you know, bridge something there. Hestia bridges almost the way in towards the dwelling place, the central fire in us. I think Aphrodite is much more of a gateway goddess than we give her credit for, and her sanctuary, or altar was present in many of the great religious sites, such as at Epidaurus, and very close to the Asclepion on coast, right on the coast there is a temple to Aphrodite. And what that says to us concerns my next point, which is...
Let me ask you, if the threshold guardian in Greek mythology has a threatening aspect.
A threatening aspect.
To get beyond.
Are there demons at the threshold or the gateway? Not much in Greek mythology. Maybe later in Greek stories. I would think by the Christian age there would be a lot more demons. Pan goes to the devil in the Christian age. His horns become the horns of Satan. And there is much more that becomes demonic. There's more separation. There's more black and white in the Christian era.
Aren't there more in the hero class? Like Jason,
like the monsters, the natural beings, the retreat. Yes, those are more monsters than demons. They are distortions. Usually, the children of Earth distorted. Yeah, more often than not, there is some difference between monster and demon. But they did believe in demons. I mean, later you get more, in late mythology, antiquity, you get some discussion of demons. But I don't remember gateway demons.
Are you aware of any common phenomenon where people have a guardian for their inner world and the dream world is a mediator particular for them, or some guardian that has to be passed, that image is productive for people?
A guardian or a difficult one to pass?
Either one, an enabling guardian.
I've seen people in their work have the figure of Hermes quite often before they're making a big change or a big decision. Some people who've worked a long time in inner work, occasionally I've seen them with a figure that's either Hermes or Hermes-like figure. And in a Delphi dream that I had, a cave dream that I had at Delphi, no, I didn't have it at Delphi, the setting was Delphi. Let's see, how did that work? It was subsequent to the dream, some inner work with that cave that came up in dream, a great cave. Athena was for me in that dream. A guardian. And I've never had an image of her before, usually with a spear. I usually subtract the spear before I think of Athena, I found out. But in the dream, it's held in such a way as though it's almost gateway-like towards a dark area in the cave. And she kind of walks back and forth as a protection that way. What?
Did you enter?
I entered the cave. I didn't try to pass the part that she was guarding against.
I had a similar cave dream. Entering into this cave-like room. And I knew there was a labyrinth behind me.
What you should do.
The black and red coloration
like he was threatening, but it was like a kind of a Hermes stuff.
I just said that, no, I don't think I've ever used that.
I think you'd find that in later stories. There are later stories of demon-like figures and trickster-like figures. Maybe with those kinds of, that kind of costume and that kind of coloration.
Mm-hmm. Yes. There's a lot of work that's been done on the black and the red and the white, too. I'm forgetting now, but I've been recently. I'm not sure if it's directly linked to the goddess, but just wherever it shows up, that if those three colors are present, this hierarchy of meaning.
Red and black, in that case. Well, I wanted to add one more thing. And it has to do with Aphrodite, since we've mentioned her as a gateway. And it also has to do with all of our inner work, is that one must pay attention to where the Eros connection is for oneself. What is the connection that draws one, that attracts one, that really holds a promise of satisfaction? Now, I consider Aphrodite the image of man-woman attraction, sexual attraction, and falling in love as certainly a part of Aphrodite, but in itself is an image of a more essential attraction and life of in the psyche. That we do have to be turned on towards life again and again. We do have to be attracted, fascinated, so that we will risk ourselves, so that we will adventure. And Eros, Aphrodite, I'm treating them as partners now in the same world. The Eros Aphrodite divine is that energy that initiates and fires the soul, brings an earth fire to the soul. It's not a spiritual fire, it's an earth fire. It's a fire that ignites one's nature. And yes, it includes sexuality, it includes all the instincts. But it doesn't mean that it should be channeled off into sexuality, necessarily. And I think the reason that our age is so obsessed with sex, as though it were the only satisfaction, or the highest, or the principal one, as the only one, has to do with the barrenness of the life of psyche. We're so barren in the realm of psyche that, you know, stories, our literature, especially our more extroverted, the things that we see more in our literature and films and all, have an overemphasis. Something that would be a great surprise, for example, to a primitive culture, a culture other than ours, where, yes, of course we have sex. Yes, of course we have our physical bodies in this relationship. But it isn't the only thing that pulls them into life. And it seems to me that it's something. Aphrodite is not initiating, or we're not receiving her in as many areas of the psyche as we need to. I could not do mythology if I didn't have an Eros connection to the myths. I'd be bored to death. I never could sit down and read an encyclopedia of mythology. I mean, I just never could. I just didn't have that. So, it doesn't mean it's not a good idea, but it just means that I'm not so equipped. And somehow I have to feel the tug of excitement and interest, and a real deep interest that pulls on my own needs and participation in life. But
excuse me, interesting because I find it for myself a tendency to find that fascination and that interest suspect. I mean, all of the intellectual arts,
You find it suspect?
Yeah, some part of me that it's intellectual interest. You know, it's not a visceral one
You don't think it's visceral?
Huh? Pardon?
You were saying you, what I described.
Your fascination with the material, which you described as an Eros connection.
Yes.
Which I think is similar to the experience that I have. But there's part of this as well, but that's not, that's an intellectual, that's abstract, but that's mental. You know, it's not that. There's not this division between notion, at least I have developed the, what is the really an earth fire, you know, well, it can't be something that's in the mind. It has to be in the body.
Mm-hmm. Well, because we are so split with mind and body in our culture.
Mm-hmm. So I find it hard, it's hard for me to sort of accept that Eros aspect of what seems like inspiration.
I've seen it in individuals' work too. People who worked in the seminars many years, and I've really seen the faces change. And when somebody has a real Eros connection, and their energies change to their work and truth, and I've seen it to dreams. I don't, not just to myths.
Well, it has something to do with the word enthusiasm, the word that you just used.
Go back to the root. Yeah, if you go back to the root. Yeah, the word enthusiastic. Any enthusiasm. Right, you're fired by the God, by the God. Yes, yes, right. The real meaning of enthusiasm. Yes, the real meaning. Mm-hmm. Yes, right. How do addictions fit into this category? Well, say a little more of what you mean. Well, by,
for
instance, you talked about focus on sex. There's also focus on other areas of life, gambling, alcohol, drugs, whatever. I think it's still trying to capture a source of meaning and capture a source of ecstasy, especially drugs. So it's a substitute for Dionysus as well as Aphrodite. I mean, Dionysus carries among the masculine gods this great satisfaction. I think Dionysos and Aphrodite are great gods of meaning for the Greeks. Maybe you want to see them symbolically there. One sees it in the arts and in well, I notice it more. I know more about music than I do the art. There isn't that much that I know about music, but I used to play piano, and in the early composers like Bach and Mozart, there was a, I only saw this later as I got older, there's a sense of the completeness of heaven and earth in the music, without trying too hard. There's nothing there to fool you. And as you go forward, when you get to romantic music, I heard Robert Johnson say, describe this once, so it helps me a lot. I remember he said something about in romantic music, you struggle to the highest mountain to say, aha, this is it. But you don't get your moment until at the end of a tremendous struggle. And in contrast, in contemporary times, you have to make everything happen. You construct the music, or you, this is overdrawing things a bit. But it isn't quite as if heaven and earth are right there in the tones or in the rhythms. But you have to impress by the way you form it, or by the novelty of your style. Or it seems like much more of that in many places today. I don't know if that makes sense, but it seems that when there's a strong connection to Aphrodite, let me try to put it better. When there's a strong connection to Aphrodite, Dionysus, then you experience, you hear the texture and the beauty and things. You see, you hear, you touch. It speaks to you. There's an accessibility. So much more is accessible to you and is valuable to you in ordinary experience. Almost a childlike delight in life comes back. And I think probably many of you felt this at certain points in your inner work, where a kind of delight comes back in. So I think finding the Eros connection, and often a dream will bring that up to you, because often we're quite unconscious where it lies. Or you're touched by a particular place, or a particular experience, or a particular kind of person, or a particular movie, or a particular play. Don't just talk it off on the telephone or with your friends. Don't just talk it off, but make a little circle around it and try to honor what that released in you without being too analytical. Just try to honor that, to feel that feeling and make a place for it.
Is that the Tenemos?
Tenemos. 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 Yes, that's the Temenos of making a territory. Mm-hmm. Making a territory for the God, as it were. Because we always have an opinion somewhere of what it's going to take to fix ourselves up, or to please us, or to arrive, or... I'm speaking very collectively for a moment, but I mean as a culture we do. And yet little experiences come that are different from those opinions. There is the possibility of being immensely delighted and pleased, sometimes within a moment of time. I had a dream once, a very unusual dream, that I was a dentist. And I had a big daily schedule of working on people's teeth. And I looked forward, though, at the end of each hour, I took 10 minutes, I believe it was. And I would go to this organ and play music. And then at some point in the dream, I say, all of my important life is in the margins. It's in these 10-minute intervals. And that dream stayed with me a long time. And taught me something at that point about the importance of margins, of margins of leisure, and what happens in those margins. It often doesn't take a big amount of time to tend a dream or to tend an experience. Well, now what I would like to do is I think maybe it's in here, excuse me. I forgot that I was going to use this. I want to tell you just a little bit about maybe we don't have time for that. Two things that happen in an oracle of Trophonius, because I think these two images may help with work too, and they do occur in these statements that we're going to have out here before the break, if you care to draw a statement. These are statements based on some of the motifs we've been talking about, mythological motifs, especially gods and goddesses as they are involved in our inner work. And they are simply to stimulate your own work. They're not fortune cookies. They're not... and you're not going to be asked directly to speak to it. If you care to speak to it when we come back, that's fine. It helps to focus us and to stimulate. If nothing else, it helps you to reject the statement so that you come to a statement of your own or a feeling of your own if it doesn't suit you. Now, I want to speak of two things that happened at Levadia, Greece, which is on the way to Delphi. It's up in the mountains. And without, I'm not going to give you much historical about that, but it was a seer place, a place of a great seer who became a god. And he's invisible, and people came to ask a question, to consult him as an oracle for advice. And the first step, I want to say this, this place was a place of abundant springs. And I had the good fortune in the 70s of going up to the springs at Levadia and seeing how abundant they were in springtime. Just cascading down the mountains in these great waterfalls. They have since piped a lot of that water, but it was wonderful to see. All right, one came to Trophonius, the seer, and the first thing that one had to do with the priest was to go to the spring of Lethe, L-E-T-H-E, Lethe, which is the spring of forgetfulness or oblivion, just the opposite from memory. The spring of oblivion or forgetfulness. And there one bathed in that spring. This is the preparation for consulting the oracle. And then the next thing, step of it, was to be taken, one had presented one's question, and one is immersed into a pit of waters. A pit of waters. And as I understand it, one goes in head first and goes deep down and is pulled out feet first. So that's sort of a revolution, sort of a... At least one passes totally through the waters. Then one is taken, led to the spring of memory, Mnemosyne, and there one bathes in that spring, and then the priest sits with one, or the two priests, and one tells what one learned, what was revealed in the pit of waters. Because there is one's answer, whether one had an image or some sense of message or what was revealed in the pit of waters. Now, I thought helpful to our process were perhaps these two images of Lethe and Mnemosyne, forgetfulness and memory. Mnemosyne. Lethe, L-E-T-H-E, for forgetfulness. And then Mnemosyne is M-N-E, M-O-S-Y-N-E. You don't pronounce the M at the beginning, Mnemosyne. What would you feel... what would be the significance of going through Lethe? Why would that be a first step? Yes?
It would be important to get the consciousness, the kind of conscious, strong conscious memory
to kind of
clear the deck.
Clear the deck. Yes. What were you going to say?
I think it opens you up. I was going to say the same thing. Essentially, it creates openness for things.
Okay. Creates an openness thereby. Decontamination and openness.
If the point is to affect some sort of transformation or rebirth, you would want to lose the old person, the old identity, and go through a new renewal process.
A renewal process.
A rebirth process.
Yes, I don't know that they conceived it as, you know, quite the way the Christians would, as total, you know, the way baptism was losing the whole person.
A shamanic thing where
shamanic,
you have to forget your old identity to have that experience and then become a new person.
But certainly the domination of the old here shifts, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Something old and dominating. And contaminating finally shifts for the time being in this way. And memory, what would be after the initiation in the waters, then memory. What's that?
That seems to me like so much of the body is composed of water. It's almost like a body memory of needing to be back into the body, I mean, connection of nature, water and body, bringing up a body memory.
Mm-hmm. Okay, there's really a lot of water in this whole ritual, and we do have water in all the healing shrines too. Great emphasis on water. Right. There is also with mnemosyne a sense of essential memory. With mnemosyne, that the crucial memory is what I sometimes say. And it's the archetypal memory. She is the one who has the muses, so she gives the kind of archetypal connection that goes into creative work and the arts, things that endure in human experience. So it's a remembering something that perhaps is too forgotten in us, an old primordial kind of memory that is stirred in us, an old primordial connection, something of that sort. So, yes.
Is this leafy connected to the word lethal? It's like a death?
Yes.
Like a death of the
yes.
ego?
Yes, well, Lethe is one of the rivers of the underworld. So I'm sure when the spring was named here, I don't know which came first. But I presume that the underworld river was already known to be Lethe. One of the five rivers of the underworld is Lethe.
I think the connection with the water and the place may be significant too as a way of making the place, because I know in Israel they have this ritual called a mikvah, which is a sacred, one place that I went to was an underground spring in a rock enclosure, and it was attached to a sacred cemetery where some of the prophets were buried. And you could go in, it was a little house, and you left all your clothing outside, and then you went in, and then you immersed yourself in this very small area. And for me, it was transformative. I mean, I experienced something that was far beyond cold water there, and I just really felt that it was one of the several places within the Holy Land that affected me in a very powerful way, and I was sure it was connected to the place. And some of the famous, there were famous sages who had immersed themselves there daily.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that just walking through that place was not nearly as powerful as being in the water in that place.
Yeah. That's quite an experience. Yeah.
Forgetting allows you access to what may missed otherwise, acceptance. And then the other one is to remember, is push your feet back to ground yourself in what you needed. Going for those times.
Right.
You talked about earlier.
That's helpful. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Yes.
What would you say? I've had a fair amount of experience with Buddhist philosophy and meditation, yeah. And there's that sense of sitting vipassana, you know, where you kind of harness or work with your mind, and you begin to forget, you know, all the things that are the ramblings of your conscious mind. And that opens up an avenue to the unconscious or the water, because you've stilled your conscious mind enough to begin to hear the quieter voice of the unconscious, which is in a way also remembering, because it brings us back to the things which are more of our essence, alert.
More of our essence. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's very helpful. Right. And in alchemy, one of the first processes, I believe, is the process of the salutio. The breaking loose of opinions and old possessive defenses and so forth, dominating things. And the breaking loose, becoming, there's a flow that finally begins again, a flow. And the water dreams are very important. Water dreams are very important. Yes. And water symbolism. Right. Well, I think it's time to take our break, and if you care to, this is certainly nothing, and you think that would be interesting.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.